You've heard me say for years that NT Factor is the breakthrough supplement that's proven to repair and renew your body's cells. That includes your immune cells, such as your T cells and white blood cells. NT Factor has been shown to contribute to a more robust and effective immune response. So now that we're in cold and flu season, NT Factor is combining with powerful antioxidants, vitamin C and D, to provide you with an immune booster bundle. Vitamin C and D help stimulate the production of white blood cells and activate immune cells, which play a key role in defending against pathogens. Together with NT Factor, they help modulate immune function, reduce inflammation, and promote overall immune health. For a limited time, buy a bottle of NT Factor with D3K2 and get a bottle of C1000 with NT Factor absolutely free. That's a savings of over $26. Just go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Save over $26 on the powerful cocktail of vitamins C and D with NT Factor at ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today we're going to talk about, it's kind of a universal theme, which is dieting to optimize our weight and our metabolism. In the past, it's been a matter of willpower and proper food selection, perhaps throwing in some element of exercise. But the elephant in the room is the advent of a new category of medications, medications that can be extraordinarily effective in terms of weight loss. The semaglutides, things like Ozempic and Wegovy, and now dual-action medications like Mounjaro. These are revolutionizing the field of weight loss. So is there a place for nutritionists? Is there a place for people who instruct people on how to eat and what to eat? And I definitely believe there is. And so too does today's guest. She's Kim Shapira. She's a renowned expert in nutritional therapy. She has a Bachelor of Science in Kinesiology, which is the science of exercise and movement. Also a master's degree in human metabolism and clinical nutrition. And she offers a science-based approach to health and wellness. And she's also an author of a great book entitled, This Is What You're Really Hungry For, where she guides readers to understand their relationship with food and develop healthier habits. But our theme today, at least to some extent, the focus is maintaining muscle mass while on semaglutides, which I think is a very, very important subject. Because a lot of people think, well, these medications are a quick fix. The fact of the matter is that they have upsides as well as potential downsides. We'll explore some of those downsides. We'll also look at strategies for people who take these medications to optimize their outcome and avoid, you know, an unfortunate consequence of these medications, which is weight rebound. Big problem. So without further ado, here's Kim Shapira. Kim, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation with you.
Indeed. Well, so frame the discussion for us because, you obviously, you're in clinical practice. You see a lot of patients. These diet medications are all the rage and people are achieving some measure of success in shedding those extra pounds. And I think you've been on both sides of the equation. You began your career before the advent of these medications, and you found that for some people, it's really hard to get to an optimal weight. It's sometimes, it's not simply a matter of weight, of willpower, that for some people, try as they might, you know, they may lose a few pounds and then they hit the wall. And then with these new medications, they've achieved weight loss breakthroughs. But at what price? So share your experiences, please.
Oh my gosh, there's just like so much. You've said so much.
There's a lot to unpack there. Yeah.
There's a lot to unpack. And, you know, there's an old saying, you can't outrun a poor diet.
Okay.
And now, you know, we're looking at these medications, which, I mean, I was quoted in Vanity Fair in 2022, the end of the year when these medications kind of just started kind of hitting, that I said that these medications are really a life raft for so many people. And I believe that on so many levels. But I really you know, have struggled in my career to change people's idea of what their goal is. And I heard you say willpower. And I've also heard doctors say that, you know, we thought that obesity was a lifestyle problem, and now we're just finding that it's a hormone and medication, you know, issue. And I'm like, it's so much more than that. And
it's not a dichotomy. It's not binary. It's not like either or. No. It really is a complex series of factors. Yes, it's lifestyle. Yes, it is metabolic, hormonal. To categorize it merely as a disease that is treatable with an injectable or a pill, I think that's a little reductive, right?
Yeah. And then there's the people saying, well, if I take the medication, I'm really cheating the system. And, you know, we've had cholesterol medications for how many years? And like, that could be considered cheating the system too, right? Like, we can do so much with our diet and lifestyle to reduce cholesterol, but can people sustain the results? And so I'm really in the business of helping people sustain results. And I learned very, very early on in my
practice. With all of the above approach, right?
Yes. Yes. And so that's basically, I use six simple rules to kind of educate my clients. And if I may just give you a tiny little backstory in how I ended up here is somebody, when I was a sick kid, and a doctor mentor of mine told me that food could make you sick or healthy. And I was like, that's it. I want to be healthy. And I thought so did the rest of the world. And so I picked a career where I could actually encourage people to be healthy. And I went to graduate school and I learned how to put people on diets that was going to lower people's metabolic diseases, right? Cholesterol problems, blood pressure, blood sugar problems, right? Reduce osteoporosis, strokes, heart attacks, things like that. I was going to do that. And one of my very first clients, when I was 27, she was a therapist and she lost 30 pounds on the diet that I put her on. And I used the diabetic exchanges to help her lose weight. And then she said to me, I'm going to gain the weight back. And I said, why would you do that? And she said, because my husband wants to be intimate with me all the time. And I was molested as a child. And it was a moment where I realized not about kale.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got these medications that are...
What would you say, just to back up on that theme,
Is
that if someone has some kind of emotional block where the, in this case, sex... is something that she feels is invasive or breaches her boundaries, that she's going to have an enormous amount of stress and anxiety, and that the outlet will be aberrant eating.
It's so much more than that, because the reality is this. It's not just some people. Every single person alive has between 3 and 5 emotional triggers that are developed in the first 6 years of their life.
Right.
And when they
none of us are exempt.
None of us, even we could love our children so much, they still would need a therapist to work on what we're, you know, with some of our behaviors and what we've triggered them to do. And if we go through something traumatizing, like 9/11 or COVID, none of us will be unaffected, but none of our stories will be the same. We won't play out exactly the same, but we will be working on mastering them in our lifetime. And where rationally we know food is fuel, when we become emotionally triggered, we start thinking food is comfort or joy or entertainment or even the enemy. And so when we can't be mindful or in our body because there's too much discomfort, we actually look for something to help numb us. And so the problem that I have with these medications, as much as I love them, is that you can't outrun an unhealthy diet. So if you don't have a healthy relationship with food to begin with, and most people who are taking these medications, and currently, I think it's 9 million people. And in 2030, it's predicted to be 30 million,
right,
which is because it's going to help so many things.
And it's estimated that perhaps 60% of the American adult population is a candidate for these medications because of overweight, hypertension, cardiovascular risk, diabetes.
Inflammation.
Any number of things could be alleviated.
Addiction.
Yeah.
Like the list is ongoing, and that's so cool. That is so cool that we actually have this kind of medication that can do that. But does it actually leave your body healthy? And I think like that's your whole point of this conversation is, you know, if you don't have a healthy relationship with food, does this give you one?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the real question, because the answer is no. Like most people are looking at, I can't tell you in the last year and a half how many of my own clients or people I know who said, I've lost weight. And I'm like, great. Did you pay attention to your body fat versus your muscle mass? nobody even knows what I'm talking about. And so the weight that they lost, which, you know, inevitably every single pound is about water, muscle, and fat and some bones, ligaments, and tendons and things like that. But every single pound that we lose is fat. I mean, excuse me, it's water, muscle, all the things. And if we're not paying close attention, we're losing the wrong type of weight, and then we're actually not going to be able to sustain it. And then we don't know the long-term effects of that. If we still have high body fat, but our weight is low and we have low muscle, did we actually fix any metabolic problems? Not that that's the goal, because people's goal is weight loss.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's actually a term for this. It's abbreviated, is an acronym, TOFI, thin outside, fat inside. In other words, and some people appear to be the requisite weight, you know, they fit into clothes well, but metabolically, they are not, the balance is not good. It often, it's concealed as visceral fat, like internal fat.
Yes. And so people aren't paying attention to that. And now we have smart scales, so we can actually pay attention to these numbers and keep track. But again, you're dealing with people. Go ahead.
Are they accurate? I mean, there's I see ads all the time, you know, on my Facebook page, you know, prompting me to buy this or that scale that I stand on. But I still feel that the gold standard is the DEXA, you know, which you have to go to a place. It's a special piece of equipment. This is actually the same technology as is used to assess bone density, but you also then look at the relative proportion of fat to lean. And perhaps it's a more precise tool, but not accessible to everyone, and costly. Yeah,
exactly. I think it is the most accurate. Underwater weigh is actually the most accurate, right? But that's not accessible to everybody. And in my practice, I've always used bioelectrical impedance, mm-hmm. which is where you put your hands on those two metal sides. Yeah. And that's what home scales are. And so there is a standard deviation, maybe I think it's 5% where it could be, you know, up or down, but it's consistent. And also people weigh themselves on the wrong day.
Oh.
We're supposed to weigh ourselves on Thursdays. It's the lowest weight of the week. And most people weigh themselves on Monday, the highest weight of the week. And so you're actually, if you were to go Thursday to Thursday, you're going to see a way more consistent result. But people are getting the scale every day of the week and mostly on Monday. And then they're just feeling like so much shame.
Right. Then there are other factors that are involved. Like if you're, say you just worked out and you're dehydrated, that could change the equation. Or if you've just eaten women at a certain time of the month.
Weigh yourself in the morning.
Right.
Preferably on a Thursday. And a woman's body is really only accurate about 1 week out of the entire month. And it's about 48 hours to 72 hours after their menstrual cycle, and hopefully on a Thursday.
Okay. During the full phase of the moon, or, you know, on a leap year. No, I'm not.
Right. So like that leads to so much like persecution for people when they're not even understanding how amazing their human body is. And if you're giving it like water, fluid, salt, it's going to take it all in, and it's going to hold on to it until it realizes it doesn't need it.
Actually, paradoxically, when you drink a lot, it makes you seem like you have more lean body mass, because the water weight is what's read as lean body. So if you want to seem like, man, I'm so muscular, just drink a whole lot. Right?
Yeah, that's funny. But you also have to be able to absorb the water.
Okay.
And people are misunderstanding that you can't absorb it unless there's carbohydrate in your diet. Don't understand it. People say they want to go on a low-carb diet. They don't even know what that means. They don't realize it's like saying, I'm going to go on a low-calcium diet. I'm going to go on like a low, you know, iron diet.
So I think what you're referring to with the, you know, with having a little bit of carbohydrates is that people who went on Atkins, it was so impressive. It's like within a week, they'd lose 5 or 7 pounds. And guess what? That wasn't fat. They were just diuresing, right? They were losing fluids, because a keto diet with no carbs, you immediately lose your body just chills water weight. Yes. Right.
And it's very, very big misunderstanding. Oh, we need water attached to sugar to be absorbable.
Carbohydrates.
That's it.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep. Okay. But so coming to this phenomenon of, I guess you could call it accelerated sarcopenia. And you know what that term means, but we'll define it for our audience. It means the loss of muscle mass that occurs with aging. It's inevitable. It leads to frailty. But you actually get accelerated sarcopenia if you lose scads and scads of weight. That's why I hate like programs like The Biggest Loser, you know, because like, man, you lost, 85 pounds, but some of that's going to be some of that muscle. And that's very hard to retrieve, right? And you don't really work at it.
Yes. Yeah. And there's not enough, like, it's almost harder to, it's very hard to gain muscle, right? You'd have to be exercising to actually gain muscle. And people don't have a lot of love to exercise because it's hard. And maybe they were high fat and that increased their heart rate and it was just harder. Maybe they have trauma. They were picked last for the dodgeball team. Who knows? But, you know, people don't like to move. I mean, I see it all day long when I ask people to look on their phones and look in their health app, which has been keeping track of your steps since you've gotten a phone. And the average American is still at about 2,500 to 3,000 steps, which, you know, steps is like a weird word. I always recommend 10,000 steps, but I really think that word needs to be movement, right? Like even move your hands more, even stand up, go to the bathroom on a different floor, like move, fidget, fidget. Yeah. Yeah.
So, all right. So, when you see a client who, just to what I introduced, a point, which is that compliance is really poor with these medications. Number one, people have side effects where they can't keep taking their medication. They feel nauseous all the time or they're, you know, pancreatic inflammation, which can occur with these medications. Well, they just can't handle it. Another reason is after a year on these medications, they get so bored that eating is no longer enjoyable. So they say, I can't do this anymore. I can't go out with people. You know, I push my food around on my plate and, you know, I can't even socialize anymore. And the other reason is they're so damn expensive. You just run out of money to sustain taking the medications, which really, in theory, they should be taken for life if they're going to sustain that weight loss. I mean, you lose a lot of weight, you hit a plateau, and then when you stop, your weight rebounds. So a dilemma is how do you prepare people for that eventuality that when they go off the medication, the same problems are going to lead to weight gain and you know, going back to square one.
Well, it's not a problem for me because that's what I've been talking about, I think, for the last 26 years since I stopped putting my clients on diets. And, you know, these medications, if we're being very specific, they're glucagon-like peptides. And what that actually like boils down to is this hormone that actually initiates our mind to tell us that we're hungry. And it happens in every single one of our human bodies. We all have access to it. And then we also have access to the hormone that tells us we're satisfied, which is leptin. And when we really don't get the message from leptin for about 15 minutes from the first time that we eat. And, you know, food, the transit time of food is about 24 hours from the time we eat it until hopefully it hits the toilet. Right. And as it travels down, actually, every single inch that it goes down, it has a job, right? Every part of your intestines and digestion has a job. So we want to eat slowly. So what I've been saying for the last 25 or 26 years is to first know where your mind is before you eat, right? Because we want to deal with the emotions. Are you eating because you think it's a good idea or because you're physically hungry in your body? And people are usually in their emotional body. They're not in their physical body. Every single person knows when they have to pee. And nobody wakes up in the morning and thinks, I have to pee six times. Oh, my God, where are those toilets going to be? We totally trust the process. And so we should also begin to trust that food is available whenever we need it, wherever we need it. We can Postmate something if we have to, right? Mm-hmm. For the most part, we have food available. So now we know where our mind is. We eat when we're physically hungry. We take our normal portion, not the portion the chef prepared, not the portion on the box, the label on the box, but what we would normally eat, and we cut it in half. This gives us an opportunity to really be mindful, to make sure that we're hungry, and it creates a fail-safe that we won't overeat. So that's almost like this GLP-1 because most people aren't hungry enough for a full portion, like you just said, but we actually, most of us don't need the full portion anyway. So we're eating when we're hungry, so that's glucagon. Then we're taking our normal portion. We're smelling our food. We're actually in like helping our digestion. We're making sure our digestive enzymes are breaking down the food in our mouth, which is our first form of digestion, which is going to cut down on a ton of digestive issues like gas, bloating, diarrhea, constipation, gut, you know, leaky gut, so to speak. And then we're going to chew our food longer than we think necessary. Many people say they love food, but food is actually super boring, and chewing it longer than we think necessary is boring. And we really are in this dopamine where we like to be rewarded. We don't want to stay in a pleasurable moment.
Right. We want to voltage down.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so we get rewarded when we anticipate that we're going to put something else in our mouth, and we're totally ignoring that we already have something in our mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So
we're eating our main course. We're thinking about dessert already.
Yeah. Totally.
But that's what you're describing is, Kim, so you're describing a lot of, you're breaking down the components of what's called mindfulness, which is being in the moment, experiencing the sensations, plugging into natural satiety signals.
Yeah, which we all have the ability.
But a lot of people have kind of lost track of their own satiety signals. You know, they're getting overmastered by external impulses.
Well, yes. And I would also say, our population is chronically stressed.
Yeah.
And because of that, our mind is kind of in the emergency room, and it needs to really be in this rest and digest place when we're eating. And if we can learn how to take deep breaths and really become more resilient, then we actually can sustain the results of these medications and weight loss. But you have to go, I have 6 steps. You have to go through them and you have to do them at 90%.
Is it possible that these weight loss drums could be kind of like trainer wheels to put people in a better space where they can overcome these very learned harmful tendencies, and then maybe practice to enact some of these 6 principles so that when they go off the medication, those will be in place? Is that?
I think it's like Karate Kid.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like we're trying to, Mr. Miyagi-ing it, so to speak, right? Where he kept saying wax on, wax off. And Ralph Macchio is like, how much longer are we going to do this? And, you know, Mr. Miyagi's like, keep going, right? Because he was training. He was becoming new. He was trying to rewire his brain. Mm-hmm. So the wax on, wax off was automatic. And you know what? When he needed it on the street, when he was fighting that kid, it was automatic. He knew how to wax on, wax off correctly, and it came to him. And that these 6 rules have to be a practice, because we do everything 47% the way we did it the day before. We are sleepwalking through our entire day because it's easy. Our brain doesn't like hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a habitual pattern. It's kind of like a bad tennis stroke. You know, you get into a flower golf swing. You just get into a neurological rut, and it just keeps getting reinforced. It's not good, but it's adequate, and you stay in that neurological pathway. And what you want to do is you want to have a little neuroplasticity. You want to switch some of the circuits in your brain. And I guess the drug may actually attenuate some of these very, very profound cravings that cause people to veer off the track.
Yeah. And, you know, when we become stressed, and there's 3 types of stress, right? I'm nervous or scared about the person walking towards me. I'm in physical pain, or I'm worried about what I'm going to eat next Thursday for dinner, right? All of these are stress, and our body can't really differentiate any of them. But our body responds in 10 seconds to that stress.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is it tips off the hippocampus.
Mm-hmm.
And that hippocampus is our memory center. And it's saying, oh my God, the last time you felt this way, you had a caramel macchiato and you felt better.
Yeah.
Let's go caramel macchiato. And these medications are quieting the hippocampus. Yeah. So now people are like, I'm stressed.
Yeah.
And they're not having this new idea that a caramel macchiato is the solution.
Yeah.
Able to develop, hopefully, proper coping mechanisms.
I get that, because I used to, when I gave diet lectures, I used to start off my lecture by saying, please stand up and repeat after me this mantra. Hunger is my friend. Hunger is my friend. Hunger is my, and what it, the point of that, people would say, what is he talking about? Because a lot of people are very fearful of the feeling of hunger. And hunger has a purpose. It drives you to seek food on the Serengeti Plain 1 million years ago. But if it drives you to go to the refrigerator while you're doing, online, your online job at home, it's not so adaptive. So to get people to feel okay with the experience of hunger, because probably you're not going to die. Starvation is not happening usually. You can sit with that feeling, and actually some good things may happen. Your body may, like time-restricted eating, your body may do a cleanup. You may go through some autophagy. You may burn some fat. You may, have some rest in terms of your brain metabolism. A lot of good processes occur. You may go and do a little ketosis, which actually may be helpful for brain function. I think a lot of people, once they experience that little pang of hunger, it triggers like a whole cascade of
what
anxiety.
You said, river afraid.
Yeah.
And I think many people are afraid of snakes, but haven't even encountered a snake. So like a projection, right? Where did this come from that we're all afraid of snakes? It's so funny, right? Why are we afraid of hunger? And I for sure was afraid of hunger. And then one time my doctor called me in about an hour later than he was supposed to get my fasting blood test. And I was like in full temper tantrum mode. Like, yes. I already fasted. I'm dying of starvation.
You were hangry.
Oh my God. But also I had been fearing this my whole life. And now here I was at 8 o'clock in the morning and haven't eaten yet today in total panic. And then what was amazing, and to be honest with you, I ate while the nurse was drawing blood. I was so freaked out.
I've had patients like that. That's a very familiar.
Fear. Story.
Yeah.
Fear.
Yeah.
And then to come to realize I'm actually okay.
Mm-hmm.
We have to develop that trust because we have not starved to death.
Mm-hmm.
We're bringing that in from somewhere else, but we have to experience trust or we will stay fear-based.
Indeed. Yeah. Good point at which to pause, because we've laid down the groundwork for our discussion in part two. We're going to talk about the six rules that you expound to transform your relationship with food to become your healthiest self. We'll get into greater depth about those. We'll talk about some practical applications of eating strategies while you're on these semaglutide medications, or whether or not you're on them, even if you're off. Our guest is Kim Shapira. Kim is has a master's in human metabolism, clinical nutrition, and offers a science-based approach to health and wellness in her book, This Is What You're Really Hungry For. It's a great book. Kim, do you have a website, by the way?
Yes, Kim Shapira Method. I'm on all the socials at Kim Shapira Method.
Okay, and it's S-H, not S-C-H. Okay.
Yes, and there is an A at the end.
Right. It's not Shapiro, it's Shapira. All right. Thanks, Kim. We'll be back with more on today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.